This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer and City Hall reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in today for Terry Gross. As cases of anthrax contamination continue to appear in the United States, citizens and policymakers have begun to consider the possibility of a terrorist attack using an even more lethal chemical or biological agent, such as smallpox or plague bacteria. Jonathan Tucker has spent years researching and writing about the threat of biological and chemical warfare. Tucker was a member of the United Nations inspection team in Iraq searching for weapons of mass destruction. He's currently at the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Washington, where he and his colleagues recently assembled data on more than 500 incidents of biological and chemical attacks across the world. His new book, Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox, deals with the grim history of smallpox epidemics, the successful effort to eradicate the disease, and the unsettling prospect of terrorists using the deadly virus as a weapon. I asked Jonathan Tucker what we've learned about smallpox from earlier epidemics.
Well, the smallpox virus, unlike anthrax, is contagious from person to person, and particularly in a population that is genetically vulnerable, that has not been exposed to the virus before over the generations, as was the case with the Indians of North and South America, the disease can spread like wildfire through such a population and cause very high levels of mortality. And such an epidemic is a so-called virgin soil epidemic because the population has been sheltered from exposure to the organism, and when it encounters it for the first time, there is a very dramatic epidemic. In countries such as Europe, which experienced smallpox over a period of centuries, it gradually became primarily a disease of children because people were almost universally exposed to the disease and either died as children or survived the disease and grew to adulthood with permanent immunity.
You make the point that in countries where smallpox remained, that the epidemics were less devastating over time because those with the most resistance survived and the population became genetically stronger against the disease. In the United States, we've now been without smallpox for at least a couple of generations, and we've no longer been vaccinating since, I guess, the 70s or 80s. Does that mean that the United States are a more vulnerable population to a smallpox outbreak today?
Well, the genetic resistance is something that evolves over centuries, if not millennia, so that is a much slower process. But we are definitely immunologically vulnerable to this disease. There's a debate over how long the protection was produced by vaccination. The rule of thumb is about 10 years, although some people believe it was considerably longer. But the majority of our population either was vaccinated once in childhood or people born since 1972 in this country were not vaccinated at all as children. So a substantial portion of our population is susceptible to the disease.
And the vaccine itself, of course, has some risky side effects. What about folks who are immunocompromised, such as people who have the HIV virus?
Well, people who are immunocompromised would be extremely susceptible to infection in the first place, but they would also be vulnerable to complications from the vaccine. The vaccine is derived not from the smallpox virus itself, but from a related but normally benign virus known as vaccinia. The original vaccine virus was cowpox. That was Edward Jenner's great discovery in the late 18th century that a normally benign infection called cowpox, which primarily infected milkmaids, could protect them against a much more lethal disease, smallpox. And at some point over the centuries, vaccinia, another virus, began to be used in the place of cowpox as the vaccine virus. Normally, vaccinia is harmless in someone who is healthy, has a robust immune system. But in someone whose immune system is compromised, the vaccine virus can actually replicate out of control and cause very severe complications, such as what's called vaccinal encephalitis, an inflammation of the brain that can be fatal or cause permanent brain damage. So the vaccine should not be given lightly. There's been some debate over whether the entire population should be vaccinated against the off chance that smallpox might be introduced by terrorists. I think that would be an unwise decision. And there are some characteristics of this vaccine that make it possible to deliver it in a more targeted way.
My guest is biological weapons expert Jonathan Tucker. You note the irony that it was the Soviet Union which championed the cause of the eradication of smallpox in the 30s and 40s, but then later developed a massive and secret biological weapons program. Just how extensive was that effort?
It was a terrible irony. On the one hand, the Soviets were the driving force behind the global eradication program, which the United States, at least initially, was quite reluctant to support. We favored investing resources in eradicating malaria, and we saw the campaign to eradicate smallpox as a kind of competition to that effort. And there was, at least for a while, this public health campaign fell victim to Cold War tensions. But at some point in the late 60s, when the malaria campaign was faltering, the United States decided to support the Soviet call for a global campaign and intensify global effort to eradicate smallpox. And there were a number of leading Soviet epidemiologists and virologists who played a very key role in the eradication campaign, and the Soviet Union contributed 25 million doses of smallpox vaccine a year. So on the one hand, the Soviet Union played an indispensable role in the eradication campaign. At the same time, the Soviet military was secretly developing smallpox virus as a weapon. It was clearly different people involved. The public health doctors were, I believe, truly dedicated to the noble goal of eradicating this horrible disease, and they were betrayed as much as the rest of the world by the efforts of the Soviet military to turn smallpox into a weapon.
Of course, the Soviet biological weapons program was going strong when the collapse of communism occurred, but did the destruction of so much of the Soviet infrastructure at the time leave the smallpox samples in those weapons programs vulnerable to theft or sale on the black market?
Well, that is definitely a concern. The Soviet biological weapons program was really remarkable and appalling in scale and scope. It involved roughly 60,000 people at upwards of 50 to 100 facilities scattered across the Soviet Union, not only in Russia, but in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and other republics. A whole variety of biological warfare agents were produced. Not only smallpox, but also anthrax and plague were manufactured in large quantities and stockpiled for planned use in World War III. There were ballistic missiles and strategic bombers that would have delivered these weapons against American cities, probably in conjunction with a nuclear war as a way of killing the survivors of a nuclear exchange. So it was really a doomsday scenario that the Soviets had developed.
Is there suspicion that Russia was maintaining offensive biological weapons research even after the collapse of communism?
There is actually lingering concern to this day about four military biological facilities. The Russians claim that they are engaged in defensive research. But these four military microbiology facilities under the auspices of the Russian Ministry of Defense remain top secret, shrouded in secrecy, and are arousing considerable suspicion in the West. So I think if the Russians want to come clean about what they did in the past and to reassure us that they are engaged strictly in defensive and legitimate activities, they should open up these four facilities to visits or inspections, and reassure the world that they have ended their past behavior.
My guest is biological weapons expert Jonathan Tucker. He is the author of Scourge: The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with biological weapons expert Jonathan Tucker. Smallpox as an illness has been eradicated from the earth, but samples of the virus remain in the custody of the United States and Russia. And your book documents a debate which has raged through the 90s about whether these remaining stocks of the smallpox virus should be destroyed. What's the argument for keeping them alive?
There are a number of arguments. Initially, virologists and other scientists were interested in studying smallpox virus because it was a uniquely human disease. The virus only infects human beings, does not have an animal reservoir, and hence it was exquisitely adapted to the human immune system. The virus actually had a number of countermeasures to deceive the human immune system by, for example, sending out decoy proteins that would interfere with the human immune response and enable the virus to replicate out of control and cause disease. So virologists became quite fascinated with studying the mechanisms of the virus, determining its DNA sequence, how it worked as a kind of molecular machine. And that was the initial impetus behind the pressure from the scientific community to delay destruction of the virus. They saw it as a valuable scientific resource. More recently, with the growing concern about the possibility that undeclared stocks of the smallpox virus may exist outside the two official repositories, there has been a growing pressure from government officials to employ the existing stocks of smallpox virus to develop better defenses. For example, to screen antiviral drugs for activity against smallpox, because at the moment, even though we have an effective vaccine, there is no good treatment for smallpox.
What's the likelihood that a rogue state or a terrorist group possesses a sample of the smallpox virus?
It's very difficult to quantify the probabilities. The evidence, at least in the public domain, is all circumstantial, but it does implicate at least three states. Russia is believed to have undeclared stocks outside of its official repository. Iraq has been alleged to retain the virus, as has North Korea, and a number of other countries are named as suspects. So the evidence, for example, is that states such as Iraq and North Korea have continued to vaccinate their troops against the disease. But, of course, other countries have as well. The United States was routinely vaccinating military recruits until 1990, and we only stopped because of some concerns about the antidote used to treat complications of the vaccine. Other types of evidence include the fact that Iraq has admitted that it experimented with the camelpox virus before the Gulf War. Camelpox is the closest relative of smallpox among the pox viruses that infect animals. And this is somewhat suspicious because camelpox does not normally cause disease in humans, or if it does, it causes a very mild infection. So the question was, why was the Iraqi Biological Weapons Program working with this particular virus? Some people believe that the Iraqis actually had specimens of smallpox virus, which were too dangerous to work with directly. So they were instead working with camelpox as a surrogate or model for the development of production and delivery techniques, which could then be readily applied to smallpox.
If a terrorist group were to acquire smallpox from a rogue state, what challenges would they face in turning it into a weapon? How easy is that to do?
Well, the first step, acquiring it from a rogue state, is not necessarily that straightforward. I mean, the state would have to decide that it was in its interest to provide this very dangerous virus to a terrorist group that might easily evade its control. Now, one thing about smallpox, because it is contagious, it's not an easily targetable weapon. If the disease is not contained, it can easily spread from country to country and might well come back to haunt the very people that released it, or at least the people on behalf they claim to be acting. So that is obviously a concern on the motivational side. Why would someone want to release what is really a doomsday weapon? But assuming that they are motivated, and of course terrorists have done irrational things in the past, there would be a number of hurdles. First, they would have to grow the virus. It's much more difficult to grow a viral agent than a bacterial agent such as anthrax. A bacterial agent will simply grow in a nutrient medium. whereas a viral agent will only grow inside living cells. And living cells are much more difficult to grow, much more finicky, require very special culture conditions and nutrients. So it would be quite challenging for a terrorist organization to produce large quantities of the smallpox virus. Then they would have to develop some means of disseminating the virus through the air, which is its natural route of delivery. Some people have talked about the possibility of a very low-tech means of delivery, which would be that terrorists would, if they had suicidal inclinations, would simply infect themselves with the disease and then circulate among the target population, spreading the disease that way. That is possible, though it's not the most efficient way of spreading the disease. But there are a number of constraints. For one thing, the window of opportunity when people would become contagious but not easily detectable would be quite narrow. That is, people with smallpox only become contagious with the first appearance of the rash, which initially resembles chickenpox, red spots on the skin that gradually swell with fluid and then with pus. But by the time the characteristic smallpox rash has appeared, it would be impossible to conceal even with makeup and would be a dead giveaway. Also, the early phase of the disease is accompanied by severe prostration, back pain, high fever, exhaustion. It would be very difficult for people to wander around spreading the disease. And finally, even someone who was willing to die instantly in a blaze of glory and in an explosion might think twice about a slow, painful, and hideous death from smallpox. So one would have to be an extreme fanatic to be willing to engage in that kind of attack.
You've looked at efforts to fight biological terrorism. How long will it take before the United States has enough smallpox vaccine to defend itself against an attack?
Well, the Bush administration has been moving very rapidly to increase the available supply. The first step they're doing is to take the stocks left over from the global eradication campaign, which numbers somewhere between 7.5 million and 15 million doses, and see if they can be diluted either fivefold or tenfold. Probably fivefold is more realistic. But that would substantially increase the number of doses as a stopgap until more vaccine can be produced. At the same time, the Health and Human Services Department has issued contracts initially for 54 million doses to a company called Acambus. And now Secretary Thompson has announced that he wants to acquire beyond that an additional 250 million doses by the end of next year. So if that actually materializes, which I think will be challenging but perhaps feasible, by the end of next year or early 2003, we should have enough vaccine for every man, woman, and child in the country. Now, it's important to stress that if there were a reasonably small or medium-sized outbreak, we would not need to vaccinate the entire country. The vaccine would be delivered in a more targeted way so that anyone who was either exposed or potentially exposed to someone with the contagious phase of the disease would be vaccinated. And it, in the manner of creating a firebreak to break the chain of human-to-human transmission and snuff out the flame of infection before it could spread further. And this is the strategy. This targeted strategy was used very successfully in the eradication campaign of the 1960s and 70s. But if the disease was not recognized, if the outbreak was not recognized at an early enough stage and had spread substantially, for example, to multiple states, at that point, it might be necessary to vaccinate the entire country. So I think that is the rationale for having enough vaccine on the shelf for every citizen, even though I don't think it makes sense to vaccinate prophylactically.
You and your colleagues at the Monterey Institute of International Studies compiled a database of more than 500 incidents of chemical and biological attacks. And in writing about this research, I guess some months ago, you suggested that public officials and certainly the media had exaggerated the threat of a biological terrorist attack. Given the recent discoveries of anthrax, do you feel differently today?
Well, one of our main conclusions was that very few terrorist organizations were motivated to inflict indiscriminate casualties, and of those, very few of that subset had the capability to carry out a large-scale biological attack. And I think we would still stick by that assessment. We were looking at both the motivational side and the capability side of the equation, and drawing from the historical record, we found that the likelihood of a large-scale biological attack by terrorists was quite small, not zero, but small. Of course, there is always some risk in trying to extrapolate from history into the future. There could be historical discontinuities, and I think we have seen some aspects of the current events that we could not have predicted from the past.
Well, Jonathan Tucker, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Tucker is director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. His new book is Scourge, The Once and Future Threat of Smallpox. I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air.